employees in groups of 50 or less to discuss plans for cost cuts, more computer-generated projects, and other drastic changes, including layoffs and salary reductions. Morale plummeted. When Schneider announced his departure on June 20th, the press made almost no mention of a career that had included some of Disney's greatest successes. Instead, his resignation was perceived as confirmation that Pearl Harbor was a failure and Schneider was taking the fall. Disney had to issue a statement denying that Schneider had been fired for Pearl Harbor. After the Katzenberg and Ovitz fiascos, Disney's credibility was non-existent, even though in this case, it was true. Eisner never got over what he considered the injustice of the press reaction to Pearl Harbor. In a sense, he had a point. The film eventually grossed nearly $200 million in the United States and another $253 million in overseas markets. Ironically, Bruckheimer, Bay, Affleck, and the others who waived their guarantees ended up making more than if they had stayed with their original deals. Not that any of them wanted to repeat the experience. Still, even Eisner conceded that Pearl Harbor didn't perform well enough to justify the enormous drain on resources that went into making the film. Just as Dick Tracy had marked a turning point during the Katzenberg era, Pearl Harbor marked the end of the Roth tentpole strategy, and yet another attempt to recapture the early success of Eisner's singles and doubles philosophy. Disney did not announce a replacement for Schneider as chairman of the studios, instead naming Nina Jacobson and Dick Cook as co-heads of the studio. Eisner pledged to be more personally involved in running the studio. Since the success of the ABC acquisitions, Eisner had shed some of his hostility toward mergers, especially since Disney wasn't internally generating the 20% growth he'd promised shareholders. Despite Eisner's aversion to having Ovitz do a deal to expand Disney's faltering Hollywood Records business, Disney looked into the possibility of acquiring EMI Records, the venerable British record company. But the talks didn't result in a formal proposal. Steve Bornstein advocated buying DirecTV, the television satellite company originally launched by Hughes Electronics, which was acquired by General Motors. In 2000, GM decided to put DirecTV on the block, and Bornstein thought it made a perfect strategic fit with Disney. As had been proven in the showdown with Time Warner, satellite offered a potent competitive threat to cable. If Disney owned a satellite distribution company, cable companies could never freeze out its content. Satellite also offered broadband possibilities that would enable movies on demand and interactive television. Bornstein was convinced that the lines between content and distribution were blurring as technology made new creative endeavors possible. But Eisner was cool to the idea. He insisted the world was still sharply divided and that Disney should remain a content company. Satellite was a means of distribution that Disney knew even less about than it did cable. Just as he knew that Eisner wasn't a real sports fan, Bornstein could tell that the technical aspects of satellite distribution simply didn't interest Eisner. Still, Eisner had the strategic planning department under Peter Murphy continue to pursue other acquisition possibilities, and that spring, Eisner first mentioned to Stanley Gold that the Fox Family cable channel, jointly owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation and Hollywood entrepreneur Chaim